things that don't exist anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's countries that don't exist anymore.
Welcome to Countries That Don't Exist Anymore. This is another one of those in-betweeny episodes. And in fact, it's the last episode, probably, of Series 2. And this episode, we'll be discussing Sparta, of course.
Sparta!
Before we get cracking, as usual, do go and follow us on all the socials. Facebook, CTDEAPod. Twitter, at CTDEAPod. And CTDEAPod@gmail.com. Don't forget, CTDEAPod.com is where you can find loads of extra features that Ed has been working hard at. Articles, games, and all that kind of thing. And quizzes. Interactive quizzes. Like it's bloody BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Hey, Phil, push for stars. Phil, yeah. You won't believe how many quizzes I've created for the CTDA Pod website.
About three or four.
I told you you wouldn't believe it because you thought it was going to be much more.
I thought it was going to be way more. Bloody disappointed.
I mean, slack.
If you are listening in America, you would really help out the podcast if you could possibly go and give us a 5-star review, because there are a couple of ne'er-do-wells who are giving us ones and it's bringing down the average. Anyway, joining me in the studio is my brother and host of CTDAPod.com, Ed.
Hello, Phil.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Phil.
Now, Edward, you are going to introduce a guest to the show right now, aren't you?
So joining us on the Countries That Don't Exist Anymore in-between episode for Sparta is Derek from the Hellenistic Age podcast. This is a show I've been listening to for a while. I'm a big fan of it, and I really think you should check it out if you haven't heard it before. So, Derek, welcome.
Thanks very much. You know, I was looking forward to being the Midwestern equivalent of Carl Pilkington on this show, except, you know, half as funny and maybe a little bit more intelligent. But we'll see what happens.
And you've got way more hair.
Yeah, I was going to say.
We have more hair, yeah.
You can't see this, listeners, but Derek has a fantastic head of hair, and so far it looks much better condition than Alexander's empire, so that's good. No,
exactly.
no recession at all.
And he's also got a very impressive map collection on his wall, whereas I've got a broken wardrobe in my backdrop, so it's not quite so impressive.
See, it's all a matter of perspective. Just turn it around and I have a complete disaster, but I'm trying to make a good face here, you know, for my audio audience.
Good. So I've, as I say, I've been working my way through binge listening to your podcast, and obviously you're up to 69 episodes. So that's a massive achievement already. How long has that been going for? Because that must be a huge amount of work.
You know, it's 69 episodes. We'll say it's in reality closer to 56. The other 10 or so are just interview episodes. But and most of the time, the people I invite do most of the work. So in that way, it's like, hey, you know, I'm not producing anything right now. Why don't I have somebody else do the work for me? So, but I've been working on it for about a little over 2.5 years now, and it was an interesting project. I didn't really expect it to be as involved as I did. I kind of just fell into the idea, whereas a lot of people come out with a plan. It's like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, this many episodes, this type of short thing. It's like, for me, it's trial and error. I may think 10 episodes ahead, maybe, and then I'm like, all right, what next? But I feel like it's been, as I've become more involved with it, I nearly quit at one point. I was actually considering it after the first few months, after I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing, how I don't know anything about the period beyond, like, say, 10 years down the line. Where do I go from here? But if you know what? If it's anything to prove, me being able to do it means pretty much anyone else is able to do it. And I think that's part of it. It's having the confidence in terms of, like, you know, it's going to stink at first. And there are things that I wish I knew ahead of time. That I was like, oh, you know, maybe I should have written out at least 5 scripts ahead as opposed to doing one at a time. Maybe I should have invested in a better microphone early. But, you know, it's been an interesting challenge. And I think it's for the better, honestly. I've enjoyed it immensely. And I've met some really great people because of it.
Yeah. So, but of all the, obviously, there's a podcast on pretty much every historical topic as well as every other topic. So of all the things you could have chosen to podcast about, why the Hellenistic Age? And if you don't mind, just within that, could you define what we mean by the Hellenistic Age, just for anyone who doesn't really know?
Sure thing. So to start off with a definition, the Hellenistic period is Hellenism is a term, a German word from a 19th century scholar named Johann Gustav Droysen, and amazingly it translates easily to English as Greek-like or Greek-ish. It's a period of time stretching from the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC until the death of Cleopatra and the annexation of Egypt by the Roman Republic and turned empire under Augustus Caesar. Hmm. So it's about a 300-year period of history, and the world itself approximately spreads from the shores of Italy to the fringes of India and maybe a little bit further beyond, depending on your definition. Basically, after Alexander's death, the Empire of Alexander the Great collapsed and descended into a series of civil wars with three main powers emerging on top. Ptolemies controlling Egypt, the Antigonids controlling Macedonia and parts of Greece, and the Seleucids, who control the lion's share, stretching from Asia Minor to Syria all the way to modern-day Afghanistan and Pakistan. This period, the reason why I chose it, well, I've kind of told the story before, but I was coming up with ideas because I've been listening to podcasts for many years. I've been, I'm going to say pretty much everybody who has started the history podcast is either going to say Dan Carlin or Mike Duncan at some level.
Definitely.
But I feel that with me, I was listening to some lectures and I thought, maybe I could do this. What could I talk about? What could I imagine talking about for 10 episodes? And for me, it was Alexander the Great. And that's always a character I found interesting in the last, 5-6 years. I just love reading about that story. But I had no idea what had gone after Alexander. And I was thinking, if I can go this far, maybe I can learn more and kind of go the whole shebang, because I can't really explain the Hellenistic period without giving context to Alexander. And also it was a good way for me to figure out kinks and bugs and what exactly worked, what didn't work. And, I got it home. I said, I knew, for me, ancient history was Rome. Was my forte. And I only knew of the Hellenistic powers as like a tertiary exposure. I knew of Cleopatra. I didn't know the 30 other people before her. And I knew of Antiochus III of the Seleucids. But everything else is like, they had just Greek kings in Asia. Sure, why not? But when I started going into it, I found myself getting more and more invested. I can cover things that I'm already very familiar with, like the Punic Wars and the Republic's collapse. But everything else has been so fascinating, and I didn't realize how interesting it would be. And I didn't expect the response it has. People seem to be clamoring for it. There's been a bunch of amazing books, both written for the general public and in scholarship, like Adrian Meyer's The Poison King, which was written a few years ago, but it was a bestseller. So I think this was a great area where it was relatively untapped. I kind of frame it as the history of Rome outside of Rome, because Mike Duncan's podcast was very ambitious and it's focused on a power that was, hundreds of years. Whereas I'm thinking, we could try to explore what was everything else doing. So that was kind of how I fell into it. And I think it's been a hell of a journey. I'm only about maybe a third in the way. And I'm getting nervous as we're getting more complicated here, but I'm also getting more excited because we're talking about the exploration of Greeks living in India and Afghanistan, and it's a hell of a time.
That's particularly interesting for me because obviously Sparta is obviously a very well known and well trodden path, right? But it's just really an interesting and alien culture, so I wanted to sort of cover it. But at the same time, when I was looking for other places to cover, I really liked, as you said, that sort of those outposts of cultures which shouldn't really exist where they do. But I was thinking, sort of these Hellenistic kingdoms that kind of survived on in pockets of India or elsewhere, with those sorts of influences. Maybe could you suggest some potential fodder for future episodes of countries that don't exist anymore? Any little Greek outposts?
Certainly. For the big two was often generally described as the Hellenistic Far East is Greco-Bactria, which is approximately Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and some other stan. I can't remember. I'm so sorry to those who are living in Central Asia. But then there's also the Indo-Greek kingdoms, which are the successors, of the Greco-Bactrians, who invaded northwestern India in modern Pakistan and the Punjab and set up kingdoms there that lasted till the first century AD. That's one of my most requested topics where I'll get people all the time who are like, are you ever going to do that? I have an idea for a show idea. You should do these guys. I'm like, as if that's not my most requested thing and everybody else is dying for me to get to. But in due time, we'll get there. We're starting to talk about it already, but again, let it settle for a bit.
Well, indeed, and I think it's a shame that there's not more cultural fusion between Greece and India, because those are two of my favorite cuisines. So, I mean, spicier Greek food would just be perfect for me.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? Curry souvlaki. You can always try that at home. Who knows?
That's true. Wow. I've never heard those words next to each other, and it's delicious. It's already a brilliant idea.
And if anyone can do it, you can.
Thank you very much. I take that as a ambiguous insult.
Countries that don't exist anymore.
For me, classical Greece, and even archaic Greece to some extent, has never been the most engaging topic. I always found them interesting in a vacuum where it's like, the idea of a Spartan culture is, you know, it is a society of extremes. I mean, it's been so many interpretations, and I think you guys did a great job at summarizing how exotic or intense they are, where, you know, are they this proto-fascist society that's like, you know, everybody, it's all people are dedicated to the art of warfare, but built on the backs of slaves? Is it an egalitarian feminist society? But in reality, it's just more of like a pragmatism towards like warfare and trying to get as many, you know, bodies to add to your very diminished stocks. But even in the modern culture, like they've been, we have people like taking the image of Leonidas and Thermopylae, you know, thanks to movies, like, even the story of just Herodotus, but also movies like 300, where you have them being incorporated into, I guess, Thermopylae itself. I mean, that's a topic but where you could just spend hours, because it's the world's greatest propaganda piece.
Yeah.
Where you have an entire thing where it's about you lose. But in reality, they've won the long game where, you know, they were going to go die, but they, even if it's like, it was just, if you put in the macro scale, it's like it was a kind of a minor setback to Persia, but look what the legacy is. People still go, you know, like there are still, you know, guns rights groups, who exchange, you know, using Molon Labe, you know, come and take them, referring to the weaponry.
Yeah.
You have modern far right groups using it. And I don't think that diminishes the nature of Sparta. I think it shows how much it can appeal to in such a variety of groups and subcultures.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, anybody can read into it what they want. And, you know, I didn't really touch upon it too much, but we were kind of telling the story of Sparta, the overview of Sparta, without the whole time, we weren't trying to do a forensic thing where we were saying, but is this true? Because the problem is with Sparta is it's a story that's been retold and told and, you know, repackaged and accepted. And actually getting to the point where you're untangling these things, you're saying, actually, was Sparta this really rigid warlike society? Or was that something which was, you know, sort of decided upon later on, perhaps when Sparta was in its decline. I do like the fact that you mentioned 300, because obviously we would stress that that's not a historically accurate source. If I just, yeah, I'm
what
sorry.
What about
Phil.
That bit when Brad Pitt does a double backflip and takes on 20 Persians at once?
Well, I thought that was great, because we'll come. I think that rather neatly gets us talking to the phalanx, because I love that point where they're like, if you cannot hold up a shield, you cannot be in the phalanx. And then there's like a bunch of them lined up and they're like, right, we're all getting phalanxy, and they push forward. And then straight away, they all just sort of dive off and start doing their athletic stuff, because it's a Hollywood movie and, you know, they've got blue screens to use and all that stuff. So what I wanted to ask you is, why was it so effective? The phalanx, and is it this idea that it's a bunch of people pushing and grunting forward, or is there more to it than that? I mean, because you have this idea that there will be strengths and weaknesses to it, but why is it so effective?
The phalanx itself is a concept that's so controversial in the sense of, when did it emerge? Was it always the same? Who changed it? Because where you have the phalanxes of classical and maybe even late archaic Greece, you know, you have your shield walls with, you know, men strapped on their left side, their spear hand on their right, and they're trying to maintain a sort of unit cohesion. It was fundamentally game-changing in terms of the political systems of these Greek polices and societies, where, you know, you had to participate in the military in order to be a member of the political elite. In Athens, it was a little different. You know, I mean, there's a whole like joke about the naval phallocracy, where that's why everybody rowing on the ships bred a democracy. But with the phalanx, it was a system that relied upon discipline and order. And you know, like you said, the 300, that's just it's sexy choreography. But there is a debate between, is phalanx warfare has what we call the othismos, a shove, or is it a shoving match, or is it some sort of like game of chicken where you see how long the other side can hold without cracking in the face of pointy sticks? With the changes that occurred, but by the time of Alexander, the phalanx had transformed immeasurably. With especially Alexander's father, Philip, there were a number of reforms that occurred over several decades. It's way complicated. There's plenty of great books to recommend about it. But the phalanx became less about highly armored individuals where people aren't as fully kitted up in like metal outfits and look like knights. They move away to a lighter style, but they have longer spears, denser formations. It becomes much more of a challenge to actually cohese the unit. But the benefit is that the idea is where you have these large, huge units that get progressively bigger and more, more ambitious, where they try to overwhelm the enemy through force. They try to maneuver and take it apart. Philip, the father of Alexander the Great and king of Macedon, had taken a broken kingdom and united it, reinvigorated the military by creating one of the most disciplined armies in the world. And the phalanx became a giant moving hedgehog where, sure, the Spartan phalanx was something you never really wanted to face, but the Macedonian phalanx was a big bristling hedgehog that moved and kept people at bay, which allowed mixed unit tactics where you have cavalry, the phalanx acting as an anvil, and the cavalry acting as a hammer with light infantry. And of course, this gets lost as the Hellenistic period goes on, where you have, you know, overcompensation, where you have bigger is better, and, you know, you gotta have bigger sticks, bigger phalanxes. But with Sparta, with Sparta, it's the idea is that Sparta is not necessarily the best soldiers, but they produce a society of excellent officers and disciplined troop formations. The Spartans were beaten. They were beaten multiple times.
Yeah, exactly. That's really interesting because that's actually one of the points where we tend to buy into the Spartan myth that they were these, you know, as you say, these super soldiers and stuff, and you know, they were just unparalleled. But I mean, if they were unparalleled, they did get beaten a lot. And you know, they're not quite as invincible. They just had bloody good PR.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at some of their famous PR people like Herodotus and Plutarch, you have to look also Herodotus, an Ionian Greek from Halicarnassus, which is like off of coastal Asia Minor in Turkey. Mm-hmm. You have Plutarch, who was a Theban by origin. Sparta never really wrote anything about itself. You have to just draw that fine line between, is this actually what they're like, or is this some sort of image they're projecting and kind of like being thought of as? You know, Thucydides has that famous quote, you know, if you measured a society by its ruins, Sparta would never have existed because nothing is there. Yeah. And I think that's part of that Spartan mentality. It's like, you know, they're famously laconic. Their jokes are witty. They eat crap, and they're a society of pure-hearted, not necessarily pure-hearted, but they live a Spartan lifestyle, is what we call it. That's literally what the term is.
In the UK, we call them Liverpudlians or Scousers. So they're witty and they eat crap.
Countries that don't exist anymore.
It's weird, isn't it, how a society like Sparta, you know, was successful because in some ways it was really insular. But then in order to exert its sort of influence over other people, it had to then sort of, you know, actually join the world. And as soon as it did that, it started to sort of undo itself. You know, you have their sort of cultural purity, which is always a myth because there's just no way you can sustain it.
No, and with Sparta itself, it's built on a shaky bedrock where I don't quite believe the general statistic of like half society was comprised of the helots. Otherwise, who the hell would control the helots? I mean, within the age of lack of gunpowder, I can't imagine you can easily control that. But where you have the society that is very limited in scope, you know, it's centered around the polis and maybe a few hundred square miles of controlling it. Like, how do you control the empire, or an empire? Like, after the end of the Peloponnesian War, they were happy keeping Athens alive and say, hey, you know, you just kind of handle your thing, we'll handle ours, we can't deal with it. Compare that to Rome, who had its own growing pains, but they had a system that was better around this idea of bureaucracy and delegation of power.
Yeah.
And then the Spartans weren't able to cut it. And by the time of their ultimate conquest by Rome, they were a little better than a Renaissance fair. So
I know, it's sad, isn't it?
It's a decline and fall, as it were. But you know what? I think the Spartans have, as of any ancient society, they seem to have come out some of the best in terms of PR, and especially in the last few hundred years, where like we said, Zack Snyder's 300, which is based on the Frank Miller comic of the same name. It is incredible. I mean, okay, I know Frank Miller, if anyone's never read comics or heard of that name, Frank Miller is a crazy person now, but back in the day, he used to produce amazing works. And I think 300 then was almost a rendition of like a propaganda piece, and it was self-aware. Nowadays, Zack Snyder takes it as face value. It's like, oh, yeah, it's cool, half-naked dudes fighting other dudes who look weird, and it's like Lord of the Rings, but not.
Oh, it is, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole thing. When you see this, you're like, okay, that seems a bit suspect, and they go, okay, I guess sort of orcish hordes, yep, get in that. And then suddenly you've got a crab man cutting off people's heads, and I'm like, ah, now we've gone full Lord of the Rings. They must have been thinking, that did great in the box office, let's do that, but make it Lord of the Rings. Throw some dinosaurs in there too, just in case Jurassic Park still's got a thing.
Everybody forgets the goat man too. It's like there's literally a man with a goat head on there. I'm thinking, what the fuck is going on here?
I mean, that said, you know, I don't mean to sort of just bat, it's easy to bag on the film. It's great that it for a lot of people, it'll be their first sort of cultural touch point for, you know, and then it gets a lot of people into the actual subject.
I still love it. So, hey, you know, it's great choreography.
No, I think I would love it if I watched it for free. I just think I paid £2.99 for it, and I was just like, damn it!
Countries that don't exist anymore.
What are sort of the great changes in the sort of quote-unquote Greek culture? I know we shouldn't really just say that this is Greek culture. It's not as Hellenistic culture, I guess. But what are the sort of the big sweeping changes you see from the very beginning to where you're up to so far?
Well, the general idea with Hellenistic period is sometimes it's viewed as like a decline, a decadence, where it's just like, oh, focus on big monuments, but not real much substance to it. They see the art of Apollonius of Rhodes and the Argonautica as like an inferior version of like earlier playwrights like Aeschylus and Euripides in the classical heyday of Athens and other societies. But with Hellenistic, the big changes, for example, like politically, the rise of monarchies was the big one, whereas in classical Greece there was only a few, very few exceptions where Sparta had a pseudo monarchy system, but it was
not much of a king.
They didn't have that much power. Macedonia, which was like the weird one out, where it had like this archaic Homeric style of kingship where, you know, leading from the front, they're murdering each other, they have big feasts, very un-Greek, but at the same time they were patrons of culture. In the case of Hellenistic period, there you have the development of court societies that would influence Rome, the medieval period. You have this development where, and sometimes it's been viewed as like the rise of monarchies and despotism over the classical heydays of the polis and the snuffing out of democracy. But the polis itself, regardless of where it's been placed, whether it's in Greece itself or in Central Asia, there was a lot of autonomy in those societies because the Hellenistic kings couldn't be damned to try to maintain everything. It's not what they're interested in.
Yeah, they didn't have these police states as well. They weren't able to control people in that way. I think we were talking earlier about Byzantium, and it's really interesting in Constantinople how, although we talk about monarchy, as you were saying, this idea that there's this king and they're sort of oppressing a bunch of people underneath and whatever else, but actually that's a great example of how the palace is right next to neighborhoods. It's right next to the amphitheaters where people are gathering, where they're watching races and stuff. And it's almost like, okay, you guys, you don't have a democracy or anything, but if I do anything that pisses you off too much, you are literally going to drag me out of the palace and chop my limbs off and whatever else. So it's almost like you're right in saying that. I guess it's the sort of Edward Gibbon decline and fall school of history, where it's like, oh well, they started as virtuous types and then they got sort of conquered and then they became more and more decadent and degenerate. Exactly. So I guess that's the thing. What's really interesting, I think, about your podcast and hopefully all historical subjects is when you get into the actual nuance of it and you actually discover what it's like, what history is like, which is like life. It's very complicated and it's not some straightforward narrative as much as you'd like it to be.
it's capturing those nuances where I think is the most fascinating part, where I like to kind of sometimes I'll just kind of go along with, you know, for the sake of brevity, like, oh yeah, you know, this happened. But then when I actually just like to dissect it, it's, well, here's, you know, subsections X, Y, and Z, where it's like, well, in this case, maybe it's a little different than what you're expecting. And I think that's part of the adventure where, you know, it's like, we're the Ptolemy, like, for example, I like the throw out, like the Ptolemies of Egypt were the notoriously decadent family, murdering each other. There was incest, but then break it down. I just say that so lightly. I'm so used to saying incest all the time in my show.
I know you're really, you can't talk about this when you're on dates. You know, you're we're just throwing a bit of incest.
How many maps you have?
No, exactly. You know, I can't imagine bringing up to like a date and like, you know, hey, you know, Cleopatra's so great. Did you know that her parents were siblings? Isn't that neat? And they murdered each. They have been murdered and stuff. Like, no, but I think just being able to express a nuance and that kind of go on both sides of the tracks, as it were, which is what I think a lot of shows have been doing in recent years, which I've been really happy to see. And I'm happy to say I hopefully am one of them, where it's trying to present the alternative approach without necessarily, like, I don't quite care for the, you know, everything you know is wrong attitude, but it's just trying to just expand it, just, you know, say, well, this is sort of based in truth, but let's go upon that further. And I think that's what a lot of shows have been doing, and I'm very happy to see that.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of the other shows, are there any things you've been listening to which have really caught your ear and you could recommend as great ones to dig into? They obviously don't have to just be about Hellenistic Age. It could be about any sort of history podcast.
Yeah, there's so many of them out there. I mean, I haven't had the luxury to list a lot of them where I'm like, oh, I don't want them, especially if it's about my subject, but
a few of them
I can say, for example, if you want to kind of go for the alternate perspective of Greece, the History of Persia podcast by Trevor Culley is like a fantastic introduction to the ancient Near East and the Persian Empire. Mm-hmm. And he also will cover the Seleucid Empire to some extent, and the Parthians and Sasanians. And I think he's doing a fantastic job. Currently, he's on episode 50, so that's great. As you mentioned, Robin Pearson's, is it Pearson? I hope it's Pearson.
Yes, Pearson is bang on. Yeah, absolutely.
The History of Byzantium, another way of kind of continuing on the story of where Mike Duncan left, but a little bit more ambitious in scope. And you know, that just kind of comes with the territory. But he's fantastic job. Let's see, there's a couple other amazing ones. You know, there's a couple ones I've always seen bandied about. There's Pontifex podcast run by Brian Fry. I don't know their last names. I'm sorry.
Oh, so all the popes, is it? Is that
they run through all the popes and they kind of talk about ecclesiarchal history and they kind of make church history digestible, which is hard for me because I'm not very smart. So I can't go through that very well. But I also enjoy, I like listening to lecture series from the great courses, like anything by Kenneth Harl, who is an amazing lecturer and kind of got me into Alexander, the Peloponnesian War, steppe empires. And you know what, there's so many that I recommend, where if you go, like, on my Twitter, I usually have, like, just I'm retweeting out, like, lists of people. They're on my show, I have advertisements for people like oh, and if you want another perspective of Rome, there's Partial Historians, which is also another great one. So
brilliant. I haven't heard of that one, so that's a good recommendation. Yeah, fantastic. Well, so just have to say thank you so much for coming on today. I hope you keep cracking on with your podcast. Have you got, so except for obviously producing an episode every couple of weeks for the next 6 to 7 years, have you got anything coming up which you'd like to point out?
You know, it's just the only thing I'm really doing is besides work and other stuff is the show. And I usually produce an episode or two at least a month. And you can find it just by searching the Hellenistic Age podcast on whatever. My website's an easy way. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and I'm really just looking forward to the next few months as I'm getting into more talking about the life of Egyptians and Greeks in Ptolemaic times. And I think that it's going to be an exciting ride, and there's plenty of time to catch up on. And I hope, you know, I appreciate this great opportunity to just kind of talk and ramble about it. But you know, thank you so much, and I hope that everybody tunes in and sees what they can kind of get from a really sometimes underappreciated period of history.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we look forward to listening to your future podcasts. They're really excellent. So yeah, keep up the fantastic work. And thank you so much for coming on and having a good ramble about Sparta and the Hellenistic Age.
Yeah, and the Hellenistic Age. Thank you so much, Derek.
Thank you very much.
Countries that don't exist anymore.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that chat with Derek from the Hellenistic Age podcast. Don't despair, because although this is sort of the end of season two, it's also kind of not, because next time we're going to be back with a bonus episode as we have another special guest from our fake history, Sebastian Major, to weigh up how true is the story of Sparta. So join us then on...
Countries that don't exist anymore, they used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for, it's countries that don't exist.